on to 092988, Nature Conservancy versus the Wilder Corporation. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Sandra, yeah.
Counsel? Should we get a chance to sit down?
Sure.
My client sold 6,600 acres to the Nature Conservancy with the understanding that the Conservancy would conduct an environmental audit and just explain to us, make a list of all the things that we needed to clean up. Well, they did. They took that audit, an extensive, detailed audit, we expended considerable resources fulfilling the tasks that they laid out for us. Now,
so, Mr. Unrath, though, let me cut to the chase here. In Illinois, the legislature, as is true in every state, chooses statutes of limitations, periods, and sometimes for torts, for example, it's a fairly short one, 2 years. Sometimes unwritten contracts, longer, it's 10 years. And as I understand the rule you're arguing for, it's that no one can rely on the statute of limitations given by the legislature because it might be 10 minus X, depending on what the judge hearing the case thinks. If the judge thinks, well, actually, this case ought to have been brought sooner under some equitable concept. And I have a lot of trouble with that as a rule of law. I think it would introduce great uncertainty into the system. And it actually isn't even what I think I see the Illinois Supreme Court doing, perhaps more pertinently, because they're moving in the opposite direction. They're saying, even in an equitable case, we're going to start applying concrete statutes of limitations more often. That's a very different proposition. So I would like you to justify for me why we should throw certainty out the window and tell people that they can't rely on statutory statutes of limitations.
Your Honor, I believe I would turn to the probably the key decision in this case, the one that prevented Judge Mim from ruling in our favor on latches. He relied on this court's decision in Maxime v. Loesch. Hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. The Maxime decision addresses that the very point you raise. We shorten the statute of limitations with latches. And the court went at some length, cited law from across the country, saying that this is routinely accepted by our courts.
Well, I'm sure it is in Illinois, no. Number one. I've read the cases that you referred to, and I don't read them nearly as broadly as you do. And number two, it seems to me a rational state Supreme Court could steer away from undermining the chosen periods of time. Suppose it's a tort suit. Somebody really knew everything that was wrong with him the day after the event happened. I guess you would bar them from suing instead of waiting for 2 years, or minus one day, 2 years.
Yeah, the as this court.
That's what you would do? I mean, suppose it's just a car accident. You know exactly who hit you, and you have a 2-year statute of limitations. But you would, I take it, hold that this was filed too late if the person didn't file the next day.
Oh, Your Honor, with respect, you exaggerate my argument beyond all reasonable bounds.
Your Honor, you think that Nature Conservancy should have known much sooner than it did that it wanted to sue you over this additional pollution, and they should have been out there doing more tests. They, on the other hand, perhaps looked at Illinois law and realized they had a 10-year statute.
Your Honor, if they did, then were clearly taking advantage of us. They waited till we were in the middle of lawsuit. Discovery had closed, and suddenly they raise a new claim. Oh, we just tested some more soil. There should be some certainty in the law. Now,
your complaint there is with Rule 15, because you can file a supplemental complaint, and maybe that's a bad aspect of the rules, but they could have also filed a new lawsuit if it hadn't been encompassed in the old one.
The notion that that following a car accident, that your failure to file suit within 2 days, a week, or a month That is plainly outrageous, of course. And this goes to the nature of the doctrine of laches.
Well, as far as I could tell from your briefs, there's not a single Illinois case applying laches in a breach of contract case.
Between
private parties and seeking only money damages. I mean, if that case exists, I would want the cite, because the cases that you cited are sort of quasi-equitable cases, and this is a straight-up breach of contract action for damages.
The first case I would cite to you is the Katsias case. This is a breach of contract case. It's a claim for money damages only from an individual against a bank. Katsias case has no equitable characteristics to it whatsoever. I would also cite to the court...
It's the only case involving an action at law between private parties, and the court says in dicta
right.
that it's unnecessary to the disposition of the case, that laches would bar a plaintiff's suit against a bank alleging it wrongfully relied on a forged letter.
Your Honor, you call it dicta, or you could call it an alternative reasoning. This court oftentimes offers alternative reasons for its decision.
But if you want us to leverage one Illinois appellate court case into something that goes against the concerns of the Illinois Supreme Court about certainty and lots of other cases that have the equitable link that Judge Rovner was talking about, I'm surprised that you removed this case. We're not the court that can change Illinois law.
Your Honor, I'd also like to point to the Lee decision. This is from the 4th District Appellate Court. This is an action in mandamus, which we all agree is equity-like. However, it's important that the court did not make that distinction. To the contrary, the court explicitly said that laches may be applied in pure actions at law. It said that explicitly. Now, I'd also refer you to Bill versus the Board of Education. Bill was a claim for reinstatement. The reinstatement claim had been dismissed, leaving a pure contractual claim for money damages.
But the case began with the reinstatement claim.
It began,
so in terms of the timeliness of the lawsuit, I'm not sure that we assess timeliness based on after-filing events. You might start out with a tort suit and a contract suit, and if the contract suit goes away...
But when you resolve the case on the basis of the so-called equitable doctrine of laches, one would think that you'd need if there was some meaningful distinction there, you would expect that there'd be at least one remaining claim in the case involving equity, and there's not.
Well,
it's a money claim.
Let me I really can't see. If you can suggest a limiting principle, I'd be interested to hear it. It seems to me if we were to accept your understanding of Illinois law, there would, in effect, be no more statutes of limitations in Illinois, period, for any kind of claim.
I disagree, 100%.
Well, how is that not the outcome?
The outcome is different because of the nature of the claim of the defense of laches. Laches can only be applied where there hasn't been an undue delay. Number one, it has to be undue.
Where is your evidence that memories have faded? Was a single witness asked whether they could recall what happened after Wilder vacated the property? See, I really have a problem seeing how you can claim prejudice to delay without establishing facts in support of that defense.
You have a claim against us that is not based on evidence, it's based on inference. There's a supposition that this contamination was on the property when we were there. Or when we left it.
And there's some evidence that it was there as of 95, right? 1995.
Yes, there's some evidence that there was tanks and that there was a pipeline there, but the Nature Conservancy, after testing exhaustively this entire area, chose not to test this area that had tanks and a pipeline next to it.
Had you warranted that there were no tanks?
There was yes, we had.
So there... Sin was in believing your warranty?
No, there was no. That came to our attention immediately through the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, and those areas were remediated except for the disputed items that were resolved in summary judgment here.
But didn't you have a lot of opportunity to question witnesses who could have you know, answered or said, I just don't remember.
Sure,
I mean, that was a tactical decision not to even ask the questions. Now I'm afraid, you know, your client wants the benefit of their failure to seek the evidence, and they want to claim the evidence no longer exists. But if the questions had been asked, there really might have been a case. I mean, the Conservancy explained who the subsequent tenants were, and they were not pursued in discovery. So
I have to question, Your Honor, the value of a stack of affidavits saying, I can't remember.
Well, I don't know what they would have said. Maybe they would have answered.
And I can't imagine contacting landowners who occupied the land after us and saying, by the way, are you responsible for this contamination and thereby willing to accept the hundreds and thousands of dollars to clean it up?
My guess, they'd be right.
Guess is that their memories would be fading.
Well, that's...
So I question the value of that evidence. I think that under the Smith v. Caterpillar decision, we do have a sliding scale. The longer that they've delayed, the less evidence we need to come forward. And then you look at the nature of the action. We're here to prove a negative. They have a supposition, an inference, that we may be responsible for this, and yet we are forced to prove that we were not, 7 years after the fact.
Before you use up any more of your rebuttal time, I just, on a jurisdictional level, wanted to make sure that you have abandoned that count four complaint.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, we have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Carl Hayes. Or Kolhase?
You had it absolutely correct, Your Honor.
First time?
Yes. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Bill Kolhase from Peoria, representing the Nature Conservancy.
Do we even need to decide the legal question of whether Illinois ever allows latches as a defense in contract cases?
No.
Seeking money damages? Is there any reason not to decide the case on the facts or the lack thereof?
No, Your Honor. And when the complaint was amended, discovery was extended the first time for 7 months, and I believe the second time for 3 or 4 months thereafter. This is not a horribly difficult problem for Wilder to solve here. As you can see from the documents in the supplemental appendix, we're talking about a pretty discreet area of this property. And one can imagine some pretty focused discovery. Was there any petroleum that was used or stored on the property after December 31, 2002? If so, who did it? What did they do? What happened there?
Did any of the subsequent occupants occupy that area of the acreage?
No. They were doing row crop agriculture and hay. As you can see, this is down by the levee, by the river. There was no farming right there.
Sorry for the interruption.
No, excuse me. So my question was, what does the record show to explain, if there is record, why it took the Nature Conservancy this long to pursue this area near the pump house?
When the initial environmental assessment was done, the conservancy personnel that did it were aware that the above-ground storage tanks were in the vicinity of the pump house. However, the visual inspection that they did not indicate that there were any issues to be concerned about. At that time, there was no further testing done.
So when you say visual inspection, I'm not sure what that means. This means you kind of walk around the pump house and look at the ground, or does that mean you take soil borings and look at them, or what?
The former. It was just a pure visual inspection. Mm-hmm. There was no testing done at that time.
Other areas of the land? I mean, how much testing is normally done if you're expected to do? I mean, obviously, you did an assessment of the property as a whole. I'm just trying to get at whether you let things slip in a careless way by not testing further in that area, or whether it was a rational thing to do.
I think the testimony shows that it was a rational thing to do because these were above-ground storage tanks. There was no evidence that there was a problem in the area, and the contamination, in fact, was 7 to 10 feet below ground and a little bit away from where the above-ground storage tanks were. What happened was when they were remediating tank 5 near the pump house, as they went further away from the source there, the pollution levels increased, which led them to look for another source, which led to the discovery of the free product and other contamination from the above-ground storage tanks. But this idea that's advanced by Wilder that somehow they have a right to rely on our assessment is really without any foundation. They are looking at paragraph 14 and saying, you know, they had to do an assessment and they didn't find this, and somehow we relied on that. They don't tell us exactly what they did to rely on that, but paragraph 14 granted a right of inspection to the Conservancy. It didn't have to exercise that right. If it exercised that right and it found some environmental condition that was unsatisfactory, it could have walked away from the contract. It could have required Wilder to fix the problem, or it could have relied on any other remedy provided for in the contract. One of those other remedies is the indemnity provided in paragraph 15. Part of the consideration that the Nature Conservancy received for its $16,350,000 was the express warranty. There is no petroleum on the property in greater than ordinary background concentrations.
So just to get my understanding of your position correct, since it was an option but not a requirement for Nature Conservancy to conduct this assessment, if I'm understanding you right, you'd be here pursuing Wilder even if Nature Conservancy hadn't spent a nickel on any kind of assessment.
Absolutely. We had express warranties, in effect an insurance policy good for 10 years against the existence of any petroleum contamination, period. It doesn't matter if we even knew that the warranties were false. They agreed to assume the risk of the absence of petroleum contamination in the contract. That's part of what we paid for. We are absolutely entitled to enforce that, just as in Maxim, by coincidence, 7 years after the contract. And with respect to that case that Judge Rovner mentioned the absence of, that breach of contract case in Illinois where latches was applied to cut the case off short of the running of the limitations period.
The Cotsius?
Yeah. There is no case. There was no such case in 1991 when Maxim was decided. There was no case in 2009 when this was argued before Judge Mim. There's no case today. Cotsius was a case where the plaintiff contended that the bank acted in reliance on a forged letter of direction under a Totten trust. It was a manifest weight appeal, as you've already pointed out. It's pure dicta. The comments about latches are focused on, I think, this idea. There was some deception on the part of the plaintiff, but the bank had paid out while the plaintiff stood by. And after they paid out, then he came in and made his claim. But clearly, that is not a decision on a breach of contract case. And there just is no such case. It's not there, period. With respect to the issue, do you need to decide that issue? If you look at the Smith versus Caterpillar case that they talk about, the interesting thing about the Smith case is evidence was such an issue. It came back before Judge Mim three times. Each time, Caterpillar produced more evidence. They came forward first. He said, not enough, but if you have more, come back. They came back with more evidence. He denied it again. They came back on reconsideration. They had even more evidence. He allowed it. Here, there is zero evidence. There is nothing, not one iota. And therefore, you're absolutely correct. Is there some need to take on this latches issue when they did not meet their Rule 56E burden to come forward with at least something, anything? We have a lot of talk about prejudice. I think at one point they even say, we can't even prove that we were prejudiced, that somehow the Conservancy was bamboozling them. I mean, this is not a tough case. Depose the tenant farmers. Depose the Conservancy people. Ask the remediation contractors. You know, what happened here? Why did it take so long? Who did it? It doesn't matter. Didn't do any of that. They have no evidence to support it. So I don't know why they argue so strenuously for the undermining of the limitations period, because there's no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for them because they didn't come forward with the evidence of latches, period. If there are no questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you very much. Mr. Unruh, how many minutes does Mr. Unruh have?
3.5.
Okay, thank you.
Probably won't even need those.
Oh.
The as to whether Illinois will allow latches to a purely legal claim, the most recent appellate court decision is Bill versus Board of Education, where it states explicitly that latches is applied to equitable actions, quasi-equitable, equitable-like actions, and then, quote, as well as to purely legal claims. Now, this is not their idea.
But the Bill case was a teacher who'd been terminated and was claiming she wasn't given a proper hearing or something.
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
wasn't that in the nature of an equitable?
There was an equitable count. She asked for reinstatement, but it was dismissed. And before this, the ruling ever came up, final ruling came up, it was purely equitable. She wanted money. She said, you breached my contract.
So I suppose you would want us to certify to the Illinois Supreme Court?
I think that would be a tremendous idea.
What?
I think that would be a tremendous idea, but I don't think it's necessary. I think that you can see that the Maxime decision's conclusion was wrong.
We're going to tell our friends on the court they were wrong?
No. As a matter of fact, the decisions in Sundance and Raintree, I think they're fascinating for one reason. They both dealt with refunds of taxes. In Sundance, I believe they called it a legal remedy. In Raintree, they called it an equitable remedy. In other words, the distinctions become meaningless, except in one situation where legislative intent is involved. When you're involved with interpreting a statute, you're darn right. In one case, in the Raintree case, the statute called for them. They had to find a distinction. Is this a legal or equitable remedy? Where it conflicts with
legislation. Why isn't the statute of limitations a statute?
Pardon me?
Why don't we give that kind of deference to the statute of limitations?
Your Honor, Judge Mim in the district court rejected this argument. It is in Maxime. It comes down to this. If we have latches, which is an undue delay that causes prejudice, then the statute of limitations can be shorter.
But I don't understand why, actually.
I think that it deals with...
Why doesn't Illinois perhaps take the view that if you give a statute of limitations, maybe it even decreases litigation? Maybe some people reflect and realize that they don't need to rush off the court. Maybe some people settle their disputes in some other way. They mediate, they do something else, and they really do want that period of time to be something on which one can rely.
When a plaintiff cannot find a remedy at law, they turn to equity. Now, when a legal defense cannot find a remedy at law, why should they be deprived of turning to equity themselves?
Because we have a merger. Interest. I mean, you have to ask whether there's an adequate remedy at law before you turn to equity.
The Illinois Supreme Court has explicitly stated that there is no more mechanical operation in terms of applying latches to areas of law or equity. The opinion is replete with the meaninglessness of this distinction, and this has been supported by Maxime, where this court had said that there is no longer any need to discern between a legal defense and an equitable defense. My time is up. Thank you very much for your time.
Gosh, thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under